This podcast episode is brought to you by Paleo Valley's Organic Extra Virgin Olive Oil. Now, we all know that many olive oils are cut with seed oils or that they are rancid, and so it's not always easiest to find a quality and properly sourced olive oil. Yes, in case you didn't know, many store-bought olive oils are diluted or blended, compromising both taste and quality, and may even cause rancidity. I'm really glad that Paleo Valley's extra virgin olive oil remains pure and unadulterated, sourced from a single organic valley in Greece. Paleo Valley ensures freshness and nutrient content by packaging their olive oil in dark glass bottles. At a certain point, I stopped using extra virgin olive oil, but once our practice started working with people with chronic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, we started recommending it for the reduction of TGF-beta-1. It is an immune system marker that shows inflammation both for COVID-19, SIRS, and actually many other illnesses. So if your TGF-beta-1 is high, you may want to try incorporating a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. Make sure to check it out. It comes in a 2-pack package. And remember, all Paleo Valley products are guaranteed with a money-back guarantee. Go to paleovalley.com/NWJ to get 15% off your order. Thanks for supporting companies that support this podcast. Hey guys, it's Judy from Nutrition with Judy. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Judy Cho, and I am board certified in holistic nutrition. I focus on using the carnivore cure elimination diet for root cause healing, and oftentimes that starts with gut healing. Okay, so today I'm excited. I have been trying to meet with Dr. Baker for such a long time, and it's been a long time coming. And so finally, we had the chance to sit down and just talk a little bit about the carnivore community, some of the studies that have been going on in 2021, and just a lot of exciting things that are going on in the community and its future trajectory. If you don't know Dr. Sean Baker, he is one of the main people, I'd say, that really brought carnivore to the forefront into the public space. You know, he was able to try it about 5 years ago and really adopted it and has brought a lot of people healing through this way of eating. But if you don't know Dr. Sean Baker, he had his own healing journey. He was an orthopedic surgeon and he's still licensed, but he chooses to help people in getting their health back with a meat-based diet. If you are partaking in World Carnivore Month right now, this is Dr. Sean Baker's baby. We talk a little bit about how it got started and why he's even doing it. Okay, let's get right into the interview. Hi, Dr. Baker. I'm finally excited to sit down and chat with you. It's been a long time coming. Obviously, most people that watch this and listen to this already know who you are, but you can just introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Sean Baker. I am a soon-to-be 55-year-old dude that has been on a carnivore diet for about 5 years. My background is in orthopedic surgery. You know, I've got a pretty extensive background in high-level athletic competition as well. I'm a dad to 4 kiddos. I, you know, wrote the book, The Carnivore Diet. You know, I guess it's been a little over 2 years now. And, you know, I'm the co-founder of a company called Rivero, which we are basically using meat-based diets and with some variation on that to reverse, you know, and correct metabolic, inflammatory, autoimmune, and all kinds of diseases. And so that is, you know, kind of been the focus. I've also, you know, got... you know, I guess a fairly large presence on social media. It's kind of growing. And so that's, you know, that's what mostly what I do. But anyway, that's me.
Yes. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you about 2 studies. You know, I know one, you're working on one behind the scenes. I just wanted to get an update on that. But also, you know, that Harvard questionnaire study, I know that the World Carnivore Tribe on the Facebook groups was really promoted that and just try to get the word out so that people would share their results. And we've seen so many improvements. It was really, really remarkable where almost everyone said that they saw changes in their diabetic states, their medications. You know, what do you think this means for the future of a carnivore meat-based diet and healing? And where do you see things going next?
Well, I mean, it's not going away. I think it's pretty clear that it's effective and people are finding that out. And, you know, it may not be effective for every single person, but there certainly is a significant number of people that have been positively affected by it. So I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I think that it is sort of casting perhaps some people are confused by it, you know, because, you know, it's very easy when all the message is just don't eat meat and eat a bunch of fruits and vegetables. And that's what we've heard for the last 50 years. And so this is sort of maybe questioning that sort of dogma. I think there's going to be more studies done. I mean, there's been three, in case you're not aware, there's been three studies done in 2021 on the carnivore diet that have been all published, or at least all published in 2021. The first study was done in Switzerland. It was a small case series of six people with SIBO, and 100% of those people, you know, basically eliminated their, you know, symptoms of their SIBO. Then there was a study, the Harvard study, with 2,000 people that came out this month. And then shortly after that, a study that Cleo Protegero out of UC Merced, with backup from Frederick Lois and a couple other authors, published just recently. That was like 170 people. And again, all of the results thus far, I mean, there's not a lot of studies on the carnivore diet or meat-based diet or zero-carb diets. There's just not. But every single one of the studies that's out there shows good results. So in my view, that should be the default position. It's like, well, the only studies we have show it's good. So therefore, unless you can prove it's bad with another study or a better study or a longer study or multiple studies, then, you know, the default position should be it's healthy, because we, you know, all the studies that say meat is bad are not carnivore diet studies. You know, they're standard American junk food diet studies, which are, you know, basically it's kind of irrelevant when it comes to what we're doing with our diet. I mean, you and I are both very concerned about our health, and we do all these things to support health, and you know, we happen to include meat in the diet. So I think it's going to continue to, as you alluded to, yes, we are in the process of doing a major fundraising thing for our company. And part of that will be to do what's going to likely end up being a multi-million dollar study on carnivore diets, and, you know, having big control groups and, you know, and among other things. So that's going to be happening. It's going to take us a little bit of while to finish raising the money for that. I think it's going to happen fairly shortly, and then, you know, contracting the people to do the study for us. And so, and others will come out. I mean, I know there's many other authors that have contacted me that say, hey, they'd like to do a study. They're interested in studying. I think, you know, with each subsequent study, it empowers more and more people to look at this further. And, you know, we can see that, you know, like I said, I think, you know, for instance, you know, inflammatory bowel disease, my gosh, I don't think there's a better treatment out there than what we do with the carnivore diet. Or some version of that. And that deserves study. I mean, my gosh, I mean, I think there's something like 3 or 4 million people in the US alone suffering from IBD.
Right.
And I mean, the treatments right now are, I mean, they're very expensive, and often they're, you know, sometimes are effective, but they're often short-term. Most people with, for instance, Crohn's disease, about 60%, 40 to 60% of the people with Crohn's disease end up with some form of bowel resection, which is, I mean, that's pretty rough. And you see how many people, and it seems like the incidence of those diseases is going up. I mean, I can't believe how many people I run into that have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis now, or 10 years ago, I don't know that I knew anyone, but now I seem to know all these people. Maybe it's because of the space I occupy now, but I mean, literally I'm going to jujitsu class after this, and there are two guys in my class that have Crohn's disease, you know, and it's just random. So anyway,
and have you recommended the carnivore diet to them?
I have. Yeah. One guy, cause I was gone for a month. Cause I, you know, essentially I got COVID. I took 2 weeks off jujitsu. I didn't want to, you know, expose anybody. And then I went down to Florida for vacation afterwards. And so I came back and the one guy who has Crohn's disease, he's down 20 pounds. He says, my digestion is the best it's ever been in my life. And so it's like, you know, in short order, he went on, you know, basically ground beef and eggs. And he's like, you know, because he doesn't have a lot of resources, but he's like lean. He says it's the best I felt in probably a decade. So yes, I have recommended it.
I focus on a carnivore diet, especially for gut healing. And so I see all sorts of SIBO, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, and you're right. I mean, a lot of people can benefit tremendously with a carnivore diet, and sometimes they may need some supplements or herbals or whatnot, but in general, it is the best diet to be on in terms of that level of healing. So I fully agree with you there. If people wanted to support your trial, where can they, donate and go about doing that?
We do have a GoFundMe account that we open it, and we've raised a couple hundred thousand dollars on that, and that's still open. We're still doing that, and we're still very intent on doing a large clinical trial But what we're going to be doing in the first part of this year, and in fact, we're starting now, is we're doing, we're scaling our company, and we're going to be raising, many millions of dollars, of which we've already got some committed. But part of that, we're opening it up to the public. So we're going to put a portion of that, we're going to allow some of the public to invest in us. And that investment will go to clinical trial as well as other things that we're going to do. And the nice thing about that is, you get equity in the company. And so if the company expands and grows like we expect it to do, then it becomes an investment rather than just a straight donation. So some people might find that more. Yeah, I mean, you can still go to the GoFundMe and donate if you just want to do a donation. But if you're interested in maybe using it as an investment vehicle, this is venture capital. And so it's something that, there's inherent risk in that, but it's kind of a high risk, high reward type of thing. And so we've been, doing a lot of stuff with some of the venture capital folks in Silicon Valley. And then we've got this company called Republic, which is a crowd equity platform. And so it's only been legal for about 5 years since 2016. Prior to this, you had to be an accredited investor. You had to have a net worth of $1 million or more, and some other things, hoops you had to jump through. So only certain people could invest, in these high rate of return companies. And now that's been open to the public. And so we're doing that because it's, so much of what we're doing is grassroots. I mean, it's like a lot of people have been sort of jaded by the medical system. They're like, man, I've had gut disease for 10 years. And my doctor keeps giving me a proton pump inhibitor or sticks a scope in me and telling me nothing wrong with me or whatever. Well, the deal. And they get bounced around. They put on 6 or 7 different meds. They never get better. And it's not until you kind of like, hey, why? The solution isn't a protonics deficiency. That's not your problem here. There's something going on underlying until you address that stuff. And then you make people go in, and sometimes many people never find that, they just kind of go on that drug cycle and they stay there forever. And, only a small percentage of them actually do. And we want to reach, more and more of those people. And so that's why we're, aggressively going to be scaling this up and, just kind of trying to work with payers and insurance companies and to have them prescribe what we do. And that's the deal. But so if you want to help, forward that and, that's clinical trials part of that. Obviously, we need to conduct a rigorous clinical trial to demonstrate efficacy, which I have no doubt we will. But if you want to, make that vision happen, that's the way to do it. And so we'll announce that on social media in the coming weeks. And you'll see the, all the different terms and stuff like that if you're interested. So,
okay. And I'll put all the information in the show notes as well, so that if people have healed on a carnivore or meat-based diet and they want others to know about it, we need to get studies out there that can tell our doctors, actually, here's a study. Shifting a little bit in topics, it's World Carnivore Month. I know that's your baby, and you and the Petersons were really, I guess, the leaders in getting carnivore out into the public and just making more people know about it, and such a simple diet to get people healing. And so, first of all, thank you for that. But where, what year are we in World Carnivore Month, and what made you decide to do it? And
this will be the fourth year. So this is the fourth year of doing it. This is the fifth year I've been doing carnivore. So we started, in 2018, January 2018. The reason it went in January was because there was something called Veganuary. And as I mentioned earlier, my birthday's in January. And I was like, that sucks. I'm going to make it World Carnivore Month. It was almost kind of like a reaction to say, hey, you knucklehead vegans, let's just make it Carnivore Month. And so that's where we started in January. It's a 30 day, January's got 31 days. I guess it should be technically accurate. It's a short, brief challenge, if you will. Many people are up for that, particularly right after the holidays. Most people are in there gorging and treating their body like a trash can for 3 months, starting on Halloween. And then there's this, nonstop gorge fest. This year may be a little different because the COVID stuff is kind of dampened some of the holiday parties, I suppose. But still, I think most people, although most people with this COVID stuff have gained weight and gotten significantly unhealthy, But January, it's traditionally people just do their New Year's resolution. Almost there are so many people. I would bet that January 1st is the number one day that people start new diets. I mean, I'm just guessing. And so we said, well, if you're going to do one, why don't you do this one? And every year we subsequently had more and more. I think the first year we had, you know, like 2,000 people doing it. And then it was like 6 or 7. And then last year it was, you know, at least 10 to 15,000, maybe 20,000. And so, as you know, it's gotten into the popular vernacular. The carnivore diet is not some obscure thing no one's heard of right now. If you go on social media, I mean, there's people that have never even heard of me that I've never heard of. They're talking about carnivore, which I think is great. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, okay, cool. The message is getting out there. And people are like, I'm just going to do carnivore for, you know, like these people just nonchalantly say, hey, I'm going to do carnivore for a month just to kind of reset things. And, you know, people say, okay, that's cool. And it's less weird now. I mean, yeah. You know, for some people, they still think it's crazy, but I think it's becoming accepted as at least as an intervention tool, a short-term intervention tool. And, you know, people debate about the viability of it long-term. I think that's something that, you know, I mean, I've seen so many people who have done it for long-term. I've done it long-term. I don't have too many doubts about that, but I mean, it's still probably worth investigating and debating. Sure. Although, you know, the studies, to do a long-term study, you know, somebody's saying, well, do you have like a data on 50 years? I'm like, there's no diet that has that. I mean, you know, the bar they want to hold you to is like, there's never been a randomized control trial done over a lifetime, you know, that controls for all these factors. So you can't really even, you know, it's like, well, I'm not going to do a carnivore diet until there's 50 years of data. I'm like, well, then fine, don't do it. You know, I don't care.
Most nutritional studies, except for maybe in the 20s and 30s, a lot of the diets now are just based on questionnaires, observations, because it's considered unethical, you know, to give, for example, a pregnant woman a cigarette, right? But it's not true, like you're saying, these trials that show for long-term. And you said, I don't think there are many studies that show long-term. People have been following a diet in a clinic. It's unfortunate. If people want to just try it, they can always just go back to however they're eating and however they're feeling. And it's an opportunity for people to heal. But yes, I get that all the time, is I want the studies. But I think that's why this Harvard study and the other two studies you mentioned are so important. And then the work that you're doing is also really big to just normalize this way of eating, because it's actually a very healing diet. I wanted to ask you, I know one thing I love about you is that you're just very real. You're very honest, and there's not a lot of frills about you in that way, so good or bad. And so, you know, as carnivore is getting more popular, there's a lot of discussion about safety of long-term carnivore. And like one thing that's come up in this space a lot is, hey, you need carbohydrates for thyroid health. You know, I just wanted to ask you, like, what are your thoughts about that? Hey guys, I'm excited to share that I'll be speaking at Hack Your Health by KetoCon May 31st through June 2nd. You can come by and say hi while I do a book signing, or join me during the food addiction panel or the triumphs and troubleshooting on a carnivore diet panel on the main stage. Hack Your Health by KetoCon is the largest event in the US focused solely on the science and stories of tools to improve your health journey. As part of the conference, there are over 200 vendors and 70 speakers that include medical professionals, practitioners, coaches, and experts. I love this event because it's the largest community gathering of like-minded people. I guarantee you, you'll make at least one friend. Make sure to get your 3-day pass and use code NWJ50 to get $50 off your 3-day general admission pass. Go to hackyourhealth.com and get tickets today. It's an incredible experience you don't want to miss. And if you're at the conference, make sure to come by and say hello. Remember, use code NWJ50 to get $50 off your tickets.
If you look, there's a nice article that Stephen Finney wrote, you know, regarding, and you may have seen that, on carbohydrate, low carb diets and thyroid function. And so there seems to be, like we talk about insulin sensitivity and how good that is, and what's great about insulin sensitivity is we use less insulin. You know, it's like, well, we get more bang for the buck. We're not exposed to that. I mean, but in truth, all of our hormone receptors and thyroid is a hormone and a hormone receptor. All of them can be upregulated and downregulated. And so if the receptor is very sensitive, then you need less of the hormone. And we know that, you know, we'll see particularly like T3, you know, one of the forms of you know, thyroid, the active form, is often downregulated in low carb diets. And some people look at that and say, oh my God, I need thyroid, you know, or I need to put carbs back in my diet to raise that T3 up into what's considered a more normal physiologic range. but they forget to just even ask the basic question: are you symptomatic? Is there? I mean, you can't be diagnosed with hypothyroidism without symptoms. I mean, I guess you could say you have asymptomatic hypothyroidism, and therefore you need this drug to make your number go up. But I mean, that's pretty nonsensical. I mean, it's not even common sense. So I think there's some of that. I mean, I think there's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that will, you know, they like carbohydrates, and I mean, they taste good for many people. I mean, I mean, fruit and sweets and candy tastes good, and people just want to find a justification to do that in a lot of cases. And they're just like, and you know, like I said, if it's fine, I mean, I don't really, you know, absent of real clinical symptoms. And I mean, I think that there are probably some people, I mean, sure, there's people out there that are truly suffering from hypothyroidism, and they've gotten their sluggish, and they've got the temperature, you know, they're cold all the time. They're, you know, they're just can't lose weight. And so there's some clinical things going on, but I don't know that that's necessarily due to lack of carbohydrates. I mean, I think, you know, it may be, you know, I think it's just part of that giant, condition that is metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance, or I mean, this whole inflammatory process. I think the thyroid receptor sensitivity, thyroid efficacy is all impacted by that. And so I think a lot of these people come from a background of, you know, decades of abusing their body. I mean, not intentionally, but I mean, that's effectively what's going on. And so now you've got, it's like what I see with gout. I mean, I hear people talking about, oh my God, I don't want to eat meat because I'm going to get gout. And I mean, I just say, well, look, what's going on with gout? Yeah, we know uric acid is often elevated and crystallizes and causes symptoms, but it's much more nuanced and complicated than that. I mean, there's an immune component. There's a, you know, an inflammatory component. There's a temperature component. I mean, that's what happens in the big toe, because your toes are cold. I mean, so there's so many things outside of that. And so I guess I've seen so many just counterexamples of people thriving with regard to thyroid function without carbohydrates, to say that you can't survive very long without carbs, or your thyroid is going to shut down. I mean, again, you know, we can certainly go into human evolution and human history and demonstrate populations that clearly don't have access to really any carbs, maybe a tiny amount, and they weren't suffering from hypothyroidism. So I think it's just a, you know, I don't know if that, I don't think that argument particularly holds water with me personally.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to see it in a lot of women that are, and maybe some males as well, but a lot of them are under eating, maybe they're over exercising, they're not eating enough fat. Sometimes those can be the reason. Sometimes it's they had subclinical hypothyroid before carnivore. And I mean, I always bring up my example. My T3 dropped on a carnivore diet as well, but I nursed my son for 5 years. Menses was consistent. There was no symptom whatsoever that I was hypothyroid. But, you know, there were some advocates that said I should admit that I'm hypothyroid because my teeth, that one marker was kind of low. And it's just, the other thing is to go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. I mean, you know, you can't just look at a set of labs and make an assumption about something. You need clinical context. That's why physicians see patients and examine them and talk to them and get a history and physical. I mean, a lot of labs are an adjunct to that decision making, but it's not the sole criteria by which you make a diagnosis. So I just, when people say, well, your lab was this, therefore that, I'm like, well, you need to understand more. So anyway.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of you working with individuals and actually coaching and stuff, because you see these little nuances, and it's a wonderful elimination diet, but it's not the end all answer for everyone to be completely healed of everything. And I think it's just working with people that you'll get to see that. The other marker that keeps coming up now is also your testosterone. So I brought up a post not too long ago about how testosterone can actually be fine as long as you're eating sufficient fat. And then someone brought you up and said, well, Sean Baker's testosterone has dropped and he showed it in his blood work. And so there's this little bit of fear showing in the space where, hey, if you do carnivore diet long-term, your testosterone will drop. What are your thoughts of, should people be concerned about testosterone on a carnivore diet?
Well, I mean, you know, clearly it makes you weak if it does, right? You know, I'm in here about to deadlift 500 pounds for 10 reps, you know, in a couple of days. So what I will say is, you know, when I had that lab taken, I shared on Rob Wolf's show back in, I don't know, got here, what was it, 2018 or something like that, maybe 2017, 2018, I guess. I've had subsequent testosterone levels run and they're much higher. So then I could say, well, it made my testosterone go up. I mean, because it was double the last time I checked it from then. So you can make that argument. I mean, it's a silly argument. Testosterone is so variable. Depending on the hour of the day you took it, you can have massively different readings. You know, if you take it at 5 a.m. when it's at its peak, it might be double what it is at, you know, 5 p.m. Right. So that's one thing. The other thing is we know that, you know, intense exercise can, in the short term, drop your testosterone. You know, in the time that I had it, I worked out like a maniac. I was breaking world records. I was training extremely hard. There's some of that. There's also, and I've made this point before, you know, if you look at Stu Phillips' study in 2018, they looked at testosterone levels, you know, free testosterone, total testosterone, and a couple other hormones as it relates to muscle protein synthesis in young athletic males. And what they found was it did not matter what the testosterone had, no correlation whatsoever. What did matter was the androgen receptor density or the androgen receptor sensitivity. And so again, it's the same thing. You have insulin sensitivity, you have sensitive insulin sensitive receptors. You have androgen receptors that can up and down regulate their sensitivity. And so things like carnitine seem to do that. Weightlifting certainly does. Right. Also, a period of fasting seems to do that as well. You know, not talking about 36, 40, you know, 48 hour fasting, but just like longer in the day. So, I mean, again, what are you looking at for, you know, when I'm looking at myself, I mean, like, I have zero signs of testosterone deficiency. Everything works, you know, physiologically like it's supposed to. I'm strong. I'm lean. You know, compared to most 55 years old, I'm, you know, you're in great the top 1%. I'm not concerned about that. Now, what have I seen on carnivore? I've seen, by and large, clinical manifestations of testosterone function generally improving for most people. That includes women too. You know, women are subject to testosterone. So what does that look like? Better body composition, you know, better cognition, better libido, sexual function. All that seems to get better for most people. Now, there are a few people, and they tend to be in the minority, that we'll see a downturn in those symptoms or those signs. And sometimes they're doing what you talked about. They're not eating enough. They're over-exercising. That can occur, and that does occur. But I think in general, most people are going to see an improvement in the clinical manifestations of the sex hormones. Now, the number may go up or down. To me, that's of less relevance, you know, because I know that, you know, if your testosterone is 400 versus 800, it may be clinically completely meaningless. And then we talk about, you know, supplementing that stuff. And then you get into concerns about it. You know, there's some concerns about prostate enlargement due to, you know, elevated levels of testosterone, perhaps, you know, with exogenous, supplementation, things like that. So again, you know, if you want to use me as an example, my testosterone has doubled in the last 5 years. So there, it makes it go up.
But I didn't. I didn't realize that the markers they're talking about was from 3 years ago. I thought it was something that was recently shared. And then I didn't know the backstory. So I was like, oh, I'll just talk to Dr. Baker when I have him on. And you mimic a lot of the things that Dr. Eric Westman says. When I asked him about testosterone and other blood markers, he is just at a point where he says, I treat more of the symptoms. I'm not as worried about the markers because we just don't know on a ketogenic long-term diet of what is normal and what is not. And so he is not as focused on these, because I asked him specifically about testosterone. He goes, I don't even measure that kind of stuff unless there's a reason to do that. But in general, people are losing weight. And, you know, he works in an obese hospital. So for him, he sees a lot of healing. So
yeah, and I think, and I'm sure, Eric, you know, I think Eric will probably concur with this. I mean, much of the testosterone deficiency syndromes that we see in males these days is basically just metabolic disease. I mean, it's just another manifestation of being too damn fat and being insulin resistant. And, you know, you just see everything doesn't work right when you're in that situation. So, I mean, and the symptoms can be very nonspecific. You know, you say, well, I'm tired and fatigued all the time. Well, that certainly could be pre-diabetes. Yeah. But you know, you might just say, well, you're testosterone less, let's throw you on some testosterone. But, you know, when I saw those patients, I mean, generally, if they're not making significant lifestyle changes, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, yeah, their testosterone is a little higher, but they're still symptomatic. I mean, they're not really improving, or they might sort of, yeah, maybe I'm 10% better type of stuff. But for the most part, I think it's, you know, it's just a band-aid that doesn't really address the issue.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, I run a lot of blood work on my clients and their testosterone usually improves. So I don't see that in my practice. But shifting a little bit, you know, there's a lot of people in the carnivore space that have now included fruits, honey, sugar, some people even white pure sugar. And there's this thought in the space where it is not sugar that is causing insulin resistance. So carbs are not the enemy. Why do you think this movement has become more popular? And do you agree that, you know, we need carbs per se? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, when you say we, I'd say who's we? I mean, you know, like I said, some people may feel better with that. So that's fine. I mean, you know, like I said, I'm not one to say, don't do this or that. I mean, you know, if it works for you, if it works for you. But I mean, I think, you know, just because sugar tastes good doesn't mean it's always going to be the greatest thing in the world. And I think, you know, if you look, you talk to guys like Ben Bickman, who I have a lot of respect for with regard to, you know, that he, I mean, his whole entire reason for being is to do research on insulin resistance and metabolic disease. And I mean, if you talk to him, he'll say absolutely 100%, you know, carbohydrate has a role in insulin resistance, and sugar certainly is part of that. Now, it's not the only thing that's going on. It's, you know, there's chronic inflammation and there's other things that are going on in there. If you talk to the vegans, it's all about saturated fat, as you probably know. And that's, again, the data that they use to do that is, you know, they'll look at palmitic acid in the blood and say, see, it's tied to, you know, problems with the insulin receptor sensitivity. The problem is, where's that palmitic acid coming from? It's not coming from dietary sources, it's coming from the liver, which is taking excess carbon atoms, you know, whether it comes from fructose or sometimes fats, and then converting that into that. But, you know, it's not just a straight up eat saturated fat appears in your blood. In fact, Jeff Volek has got a nice study from 2013 that basically shows the opposite. You know, as fat, saturated fat doubles in the diet, blood concentration don't even change. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like I said, I know there's people are saying it's all about linoleic acid. It's all, you know, it's, that's everything, you know, because the Egyptians got fat and heart disease, but it's not because they were eating grain and wheat and stuff. It was because of, you know, this or that. And, you know, they're saying that, sugar had no impact on this stuff. And I don't see it. I think both of these things probably have a role, you know, and I think it's one of those things that's more nuanced and more complicated. And, you know, if you know, you put somebody on a diet that is mostly sugar, you're going to have problems. I mean, I think that's pretty clear, you know, and I think there's, you know, I mean, there's plenty of data that shows that there's problems. You know, I mean, you look at Robert Lustig's work, and some people criticize that, but there's a number of people that have looked into some of the problems with fructose and with sucrose and high fructose corn syrup and, you know, refined carbohydrates and carbohydrates in general. So there's, I mean, there is a breadth of knowledge and literature that would point to that as at least partially causal in this stuff. May not be the only thing.
Yeah. I spoke with Dr. Ben Bickman recently. And one of the things of many of the things you talked about that he touched upon is that just the reality is that sugar just has no nutrition. And so when you eat it, your insulin will go up. And the more you're hungry, you'll eat more. And then the fact that there's no nutrition, you're going to eat more and more. And that itself will then increase your insulin. And that's where sugar is not ideal. Do you have any concerns with, you know, we eat a lot of fat on a carnivore diet. And then we eat a lot of, some people are using also carbohydrates for energy. And there's two sources of energy. Do you think it's a concern long-term for people eating a meat-based diet, adding a lot of fructose, for example, or, you know, some other form of sugary carbohydrates?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can see where there's a potential concern for that. I mean, I think that, you know, and again, it depends, probably some of it depends on the dose, right? I mean, many of these things, the dose makes the poison. So yes. you have to consider that. I mean, there's animal studies looking at fructose and saying, you know, what is the amount of fructose you can eat before you start developing things like fatty liver. And, right. You know, I think the study that I looked at, I mean, I haven't looked this well, so I may be off on that, but it was like, you know, a gram per kilogram of body weight on an animal. And does that translate directly to a human? And if you did, you'd say, well, then it's like for an average person, 75 grams or something like that. So if you're getting 75 grams of sugar a day, which is a decent amount, you're going to have problems. And I think most people at that level would see problems. And so here's the thing, you know, there's so many avenues you can go on this topic. But one thing, you know, when we see like concerns around meat and some of the metabolites from digestion of meat causing gut problems, you know, colorectal cancer, you know, I talk about, and they say, well, it could be related to heme, or, you know, it could be related to these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, but it could be related to things like TMAO, trimethylamine oxide. And what we're seeing is that may be a concern if the gut is broken. You know, if you've got a dysbiotic gut, a dysfunctional gut, a hyperpermeable gut, then you see, or, you know, we see that in chronic kidney disease too. You know, these right. TMAO levels accumulate only in that situation. So if you're putting meat into a high sugar diet and that's causing gut issues, then you might have these downstream second effects. And so I don't know. I mean, again, if you can eat, you know, if you eat like, I know some people are like, they're eating, I don't know, 100 grams, 50 grams of honey, and I don't know how much fruit. And for them, that may be just a level enough that where their gut stays healthy and it's not causing problems and the meat doesn't cause a problem. But then, you know, we get to why are there so many people with broken guts that you see all the time? I know that's one of the things you specialize in. Right. And so it's probably because they've been, you know, eating enough of whatever foods it is, and sugar may be part of that. You know, I mean, you know, you get these people at Repeat where they're just saying, hey, drink Coca-Cola, the Mexican Coke, because it's got real sugar in it or something. You know, I mean, this stuff, which I think is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But if you're doing that and then you start developing this gut dysbiosis and then you put meat on top of that, then you might start seeing some of these potentially deleterious compounds. And so I think it's, you know, it's not the meat itself. It's the environment that it's put in. You know, some people would say it's not the meat, but it's how you cook it. I have disagreements with that just based on the lack of data that supports that, and the fact that we've been cooking meat over fire for 400,000 to 2 million years, depending on who you read. So yeah, I mean, I think that the whole issue with can sugar cause problems with a meat diet potentially. I don't know though. I mean, you know, like I said, I think it makes sense to, you know, I've always been supportive of, hey, be objective about what you're doing. If you're eating some, you know, 2 scoops of honey every day and 3 bananas and you're fine, good. I mean, that's fine. Great for you. But I mean, like to say that everybody must do that
right.
in order to save their thyroid or prevent gluconeogenesis or whatever kind of wacko craziness they say is so horrible. I disagree with that because I've just seen too many people that don't do that, that are, I mean, literally thriving, best they've been in their health in their life. So.
Yeah. And yeah, I appreciate
just go to.
No, and I just appreciate everything you're saying right now, because I'm on the same page. I think that as we heal, if we want to be flexible and try other things and not feel limited or bogged down by a diet, I think it's great if you want to introduce vegetables and fruits. If you, like you're saying, you're objective and you can handle it and your body can tolerate it, if you were always metabolically healthy, those are great things. I think the difference is when, and my heartburn over all of it was when people are saying, no, you cannot do this diet because if you do, here are the risks for your health. And so this diet is adverse for your condition. And that's where it was so sad because I just posted this not too long ago, but most Americans, they don't have a lot of money to eat the healthiest foods. But if you are a carnivore, you can eat really cheap meats and eggs and bacons and still heal. And it's just a diet that if people could hear about it and hear how amazing efficacious it is, then it's a way that we can wake up society, that we can all heal. But when you take it away, so if someone brand new came into the space and started learning about carnivore, they would think, depending on who you're listening to, that you need to include a little bit of fruit or a little bit of carbs, because otherwise you will ruin your thyroid. And Dr. Ben Bickman just said that he learned not too long ago that levothyroxine, the thyroid medication, is the number 2 selling medication in America or maybe the world. And so if you know that, and then if someone's coming into carnivore thinking their thyroid will get ruined, they're going to leave the carbs in. And I wonder, could we have allowed them to really heal first before they start incorporating back some of those carbohydrates?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And I, like I said, if you do 3-6 months of a pure strict carnivore diet and you heal, and then you want to add something in later, yeah, that makes sense. But to say that you cannot do a carnivore diet without eating this specific cut of meat, or, you know, I have the other issues with organ meats and you have to have fruit and honey and that sort of stuff. I mean, I think it's disingenuous. I mean, you know, we have this Harvard study where they just published, and I think the longest person in that study was 28 years. I mean, 28 years on the diet.
Okay.
So, I mean, did they ruin their thyroid? I don't know, but I mean, I didn't see their thyroid numbers, but I mean, I suspect not.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's one of those things where when you overcomplicate things and you make them very expensive unnecessarily, it's a problem. But I want, you know, back to, you know, like you mentioned, you know, can you do this and add this and that? One of the things we're doing with the companies, we're using AI to solve some of those problems.
Oh,
so when we start looking at someone with psoriasis, they may have a different level of tolerance to foods than someone with, say, diabetes or someone with depression.
Right.
You know, it's, I mean, you can throw carnivore in there as a baseline elimination diet. And yes, it's often very effective. But like you pointed out, some people need to do more. For some people, it's exercise. For some people, it's sleep management. For some people, it's, you know, light exposure. For some people, it's stress mitigation. For some people, it can be some of these nutritional, you know, adjuvants that you might put in there. And so what we're trying to find out is what's different between one person and the other based on their demographics. You know, a 52-year-old premenopausal female with depression and diabetes may be very different than a 17-year-old with those same conditions, you know, a 17-year-old male of, you know, different ethnic background. There's maybe very different food things that are problematic. And so we will figure that stuff out. And we're already figuring a lot of that out. And that allows us to, you know, sort of give people a little bit more flexibility, maybe tailor things a little quicker for them.
Yeah. And I think that's really smart because even in the space, you'll see trends. And I mean the carnivore space. So I work with a lot of women between like 30s and 60s, and then they are a different population, especially if they have a little bit of weight to lose versus the people that are like CrossFitters that decided to do carnivore because they just wanted a cleaner diet and their needs seem to be different. So I do see that. And so that would be really smart to use AI to figure that out for people so that, you know, it's just a lot more customized as soon as they even start to eat a carnivore diet. I think that's really smart. I think you sort of answered the question as to why the name change, but I know there were some questions in this community about why MeatRx turned to Rivero. I think you just kind of alluded to it, but if you can just share, you know, why the name change.
Yeah, absolutely. So our goal is to be a full service health company. Our goal is to serve hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And when we look at nomenclature, naming companies, what's scalable, what's not, unfortunately, meat has such a negative stigma that a lot of people will just, without even thinking about it, just say, oh, this is crazy. We're not going to do it. Even if if you were meat plus blueberries, people are like, oh, that's great. That, I mean, but the idea of only eating meat or being a meat-based company is off-putting to a lot of people, including like investors and companies and stuff like that. So if we look at companies like Virta Health, which, by the way, now is a $2 billion company, just to put that out, they've scaled pretty significantly, and there's no reason we're not going to be able to do the same thing. Livongo, Omada, Achilles, Pear, all these things that are these digital health platforms, their names are just, they don't mean anything. It's something, what they are is they're not offensive. You know, we went through literally hundreds of different naming options and trying to find the ones that weren't already trademarked or somebody else didn't own the rights to, trying to find the ones that weren't offensive in other language. You know, there's little programs you put in a word and see if it means a swear word in another language or something or something bad in another language. So you had to come through all that stuff. And so, I mean, again, the reason was we wanted to make it, we didn't want to turn people off just on the name only. And you know, it's not that we're a vegan company or a plant-based. We're certainly not. We're always going to include meat in the diet. I mean, to be completely transparent, our AI will sort of help guide this, but I have no doubt that it's going to end up with some form of a meat-based diet. Now, maybe, you know, for different people, you know, obviously with diabetics, it's probably going to show a low-carb diet improves it. Obviously, for people with IB, you know, autoimmune things, it's probably going to be something along the lines of an AIP diet, depending what's in there. And so, but we're going to get real world data. You know, it's like somebody asked, well, why can't you just get like do food sensitivity testing, like IgG studies? And we're like, well, that may show you what food reaction when you prick your skin gives you an IgG response, but does it actually show clinically, does it make a difference in your mental health? Does it make a difference in your knee pain? And if you're not measuring that, you don't know. And so we're actually measuring the actual clinical outcomes and working backwards. And we're not so worried about the individual biomarkers to a degree. You know, for things like diabetes, yes, it makes sense because when you're deprescribing, medications like insulin. And that's the other thing that I think we talked about the Harvard study. If you looked in there, the thing that was really exciting for me was, you know, the rate of medication removal on these diabetics. I mean, it was something like 92% got off insulin, 100% got off all other injectable medications, and 84% got off all their oral medications, including metformin, which is something that people often stay on for their whole life regardless. And so it's very powerful. It's a very powerful treatment that we see. And, like you said, yes, a very active person is going to have a different dietary tolerance and dietary composition than someone who's kind of sedentary, like a sedentary 55-year-old is going to have different needs than a 22-year-old athlete for sure.
Yeah. So, as we're coming to a close, what are some of the tips for, just brand new carnivores that are trying to do World Carnivore Month? What would be some, for the last 5 years you've been doing carnivore, what are some tips to just get started and be successful for a full month of being carnivore?
So I think, relax, have fun, enjoy it, make the food fun. I think variety is fun. It's key. I mean, like I said, if you're just going to do it for a month and leave, okay, that's fine. I mean, a lot of people, if you're coming to this and you're like, hey, I want to get rid of my hypothyroidism, or right, I want to get rid of my, Crohn's disease, that's a different sort of outlook. And you're probably going to want to be on it longer anyway. But I think for most people transitioning in, include a variety of different meats that you like, eggs, dairy is one of those things where a lot of people don't do well with it. But, if in the beginning, if I told everybody, hey, welcome to carnivore month, you get dry ground beef and nothing else for the rest of the month, and that's all you're going to eat every day, three meals a day, no one would want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. So if you can say, hey, you're going to have some ground beef, throw a little seasoning in there, throw a little bit of shredded cheese on there, have a ball, eat it up. Get through the month, eat enough, don't starve yourself. So even if you have a lot of weight to lose, and many people do, and many people come to this for that, I think that the first thing you need to do is sort of change your whole rationale for eating, your relationship with food. And so if you go into the diet and you say, well, I got to lose weight, so I'm going to eat, 1200 calories or 1600 calories, and I'm going to really restrict everything and fast all day long, you're just going to fail. You're just going to be miserable. You're going to be hungry. You're going to have cravings. You're going to last about 3 or 4 days, and then you're going to be chowing down pizzas and ice cream. I mean, that's just the way it is. So I think in the beginning, just eat your fill. It's basic. We've all heard advice: eat till you're full. Eat again when you're, don't eat when you're not full. Eat enough till you feel full, and then eat whenever when you need to. I think including enough fat in the diet. Obviously, if you're trying to do it on chicken breast and lean sirloin steaks, you're going to struggle. So get enough fat in there. Can you overeat fat? Yes, you can. But I wouldn't worry about that in the beginning. I mean, right, I wouldn't sit there and just eat gobs of butter and drink down pints of heavy cream. That's not a good solution either. I mean, it's just eat some meat. If it's got some fat on it, great. Eat the fat with it. A lot of people just they can't eat the fat on meat for whatever reason. They're always cutting it off because out of habit. And I think that's something you have to get away from, at least for this. Because if you're not having carbohydrates, you got to get energy from somewhere. And so you're going to need to eat a little more fat than maybe perhaps you're used to. And the other thing is, some people will find, we'll see some GI upset. And so some people might need to parse that fat out into smaller doses across the day. And so you might break it up into more meals rather than less meals, because so many people gravitate to one meal a day, two meals a day, they eat relatively large meals. And sometimes you can have a large bolus of fat in there, and that can lead to fat malabsorption, because you're just not able to, you just don't have the capacity to handle 100 grams of fat in one sitting, or whatever it turns out to be. That capacity changes over time, by the way. Right. But in the beginning, you may overwhelm yourself.
As humans, we get really excited about a new diet or a new way of change. And that's why New Year's always has, as part of the resolutions, like everyone wants to lose weight or get on a new diet. And part of the problem is then we want to go all in, right? So our mind is working way faster than maybe we are realistically able to do. And so I see people start doing OMAD and intermittent fasting, and they're just going to eat the cleanest meats, and then they're going to start exercising. And so then they're really over their heads. And so then it becomes really hard to do carnivore, when if you just were to eat the meats you enjoy, not worry too much about macros and how many calories you're eating, but just eat to satiety and then change things as you go. Just to get assimilated. I think that's such a powerful tool, because for everything I see, the biggest success marker is consistency. And it sounds like what you're talking about is really what will allow people to be consistent.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing like people trying to give up coffee. They're trying to do too many things at once. And I think just get used to not having the starch on your plate or the vegetables on your plate. That's, you know, for you guys who've never done that, that alone is just a new paradigm for a lot of people. And so when you put too much pressure on there, because, you know, you'll see, I mean, there's so many success stories. We've got countless people that have lost 50, 80, 100 pounds. I mean, those people are all over the place. And so somebody will come in there and think, well, I got to do that too. And I think, you know, I think the first step, again, is change your relationship with the food, right? Enjoy what you're doing. I mean, the two consistent things for failure are you're hungry all the time or you don't like the food.
Right.
And if the diet makes you hungry and you don't like the food, you are not going to stick with it. Not for very long. You might do it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but if you don't like what you're eating, you know, you need to find a different diet.
Right. No. That's really good. So how does Rivero work? So do people just join in at any time? Is it like at the very beginning of the month? What is Rivero? And if people have never heard of it, if you can just share, you know, where people can join and where can people find you?
Right. Okay. So Rivero, so you can go to Rivero.com. It's R-E-V-E-R-O, kind of like reverse Rivero. And so what it is, you know, I mean, it is, you know, a resource center. First of all, we have, you know, videos, educational material. We've got thousands of research. So if you're looking for research to back up what you're doing to show to your doctor, your friends about health and the environment and all that stuff, that's all on there. We've got recipes. We've got discounts and deals on all kinds of carnivore related stuff. We have direct links to ranchers with discounts. We have a large list of local ranchers. We have physicians that are carnivore friendly listed on our site that you can go see. We have coaching is available. We have very, very inexpensive coaching for people. New members get a free coaching session just to start with. You can join up for free for a month. You don't have to, you know, you can do it for a month and you don't like it, you can leave. And then we have, you know, the meetings. And so we have meetings throughout the day. Most of the day is covered. I mean, 7 days a week, there's always a meeting going on every day. And usually there's 5, 6, 7, 8 meetings a day. So you can always kind of find people that you want to talk to. You know, I have a meeting every morning at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And I usually have anywhere from 40 to 100 people in the meeting. And we just chat and something like, but often I'm just in there. I might go over study. I might just open it up for open discussion. People ask me questions directly. And so we do that. And it's real supportive. And one of the things I've found is despite the fact you can give people knowledge, you can have a perfect plan for them. If they don't feel supported or don't have some avenue to get some support from or some accountability, it's much harder for them. You know, and the data shows that. I mean, the data we have, if you don't have support, your likelihood of success goes down significantly. So, you know, if you don't have a supportive spouse or you don't have a supportive boss or you don't have a supportive doctor or friends, the odds of you succeeding are much lower than if you do. And, you know, and with carnivore, I mean, even though we're growing, it's still not that common for somebody to say, yeah, go carnivore. I mean, most of the time they look at you like you got a third eyeball, right? Or, you know, they're telling you, oh, wait for your heart attack or you're going to get cancer or, you know, the stuff we all hear, which is, you know, by the way, nonsense. But yeah, that's what we do at Rivero. So Rivero.com, my sort of social media stuff, I'm on Instagram at Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Baker, B-A-K-E-R, 1967. I've got a YouTube channel, which I'm currently suspended for another 10 days.
Oh, you're suspended?
Yeah, it's the third time I've been suspended in the last 3 or 4 months. So it's kind of it's sad. It's the censorship stuff has gotten out of hand. It's unfortunate. And then I'm on Twitter. I got my Twitter account back, which I was permanently banned from Twitter, and then they changed their mind. I'm back on Twitter. So S Baker MD. So anyway, those are the places you can find me. Typically, I don't really hang out on Facebook that much. I never really got into it, even though, you know, the World Carnivore Tribe, it's my site. I started that, but I'm rarely there just because I just don't like the Facebook interaction for some reason. I'm not sure why, but I just never gelled with me.
One thing I want to say about Rivero is, you know, I've been part of, obviously I've done interviews with you, but I've also been part of a few of the community groups, and they're really powerful. Like, you have one for mental health, you have one for eating disorders, and there's a lot of support if people take the initiative. And so whenever someone new comes to Carnivore, I always say to actually go to Rivero and other groups for that community support to just get the basics and even work with some of your coaches, because I think that's where people should start, at least for the support. And then if things aren't working later, maybe they really have deeper gut issues, then they can maybe come to me or other, like, you know, doctors or practitioners. But that's a place where there's a lot of care. And for all of the groups that I've been in, there's a lot of power with just people sharing their stories and their frustrations and just feeling that you're very normal and you have that support on a daily basis. And I think that's such a powerful thing that you guys offer. So yeah, I wanted to commend you. And some of the people I've just talked to in your community, they're great. So it's just, I always recommend you guys when someone is starting carnivore.
Yeah. And just, you know, just to reiterate our, you know, the plans, I mean, we will be a full service health company, and you'll have Rivero doctors that are there that are going to support people on animal based diet. So you'll have a doctor that you can actually, you know, have as your doctor. And so that's going to be, among other things, and we'll have a whole bunch of other things. So anyway, well, thank you so much, Judy. It's been a pleasure. It's great talking to you. And I guess I'll see you again, you know, in about a month. So it'll be great.
So thank you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Judy. Appreciate it.
I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Dr. Sean Baker is just very honest and open. There's a lot of healing that needs to be done in our communities. And I'm grateful for people like Dr. Sean Baker that has the resources, that shares his time, and that advocates for this way of eating so that more people can get to this diet. When I first heard of the name change, I was a little confused. And then I know other people were, but it makes sense as he is trying to get more people to adopt. And sometimes you just got to get people in any which way you can. And as people heal, they may just eliminate down to a meat-only diet anyway. Over time, it's really just getting people to try meat-based and seeing how much healing they can have. So I think it's exciting times for carnivore. There's a lot of things going on, but it's just exciting because we can really heal people with such basic foods and we may not need medicine. I hope that this conversation gives you strength and encouragement during World Carnivore Month. Make sure to eat a lot of meat. Take care of your bodies because it is the only place you have to live. I will talk to you guys later. Take care. Bye. Thanks for listening to the Nutrition with Judy podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please make sure to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app so more listeners like you can find the show. If you want more practitioner care and support, head over to nutritionwithjudy.com/groups so you can get more real talk about carnivore, the environment, and root cause healing. You can also find my content on Nutrition with Judy's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Make sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter and learn more about in-depth articles with infographics at nutritionwithjudy.com/articles. You can find my two books, Carnivore Cure and The Complete Carnivore Diet for Beginners, on carnivorecure.com and amazon.com. At the heart of Nutrition with Judy's practice, our mission lies with a deep, unwavering passion for service and community. We will continue to empower you to have the knowledge and tools to live a life nearly symptom-free, because we firmly believe in healing and wellness for all.